Okay, I'd like to call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:02 p.m. on May 2nd, 2023. We're meeting today in Davis Room 106 of the Capitol Building. And please silence your cell phone out of courtesy to others. With us today, we have Representative Sadler, Representative Ruffridge, Representative McCormick, Representative Fields, and myself, the chair, Representative Prox. And so we do have a quorum, and I'd like to introduce my committee maid to our right, your left, Riley Nye. If you need to get something done, get Riley's attention. And our returning House records recorder, inimitable Suniva St. Clair, and Amanda Kraft, our teleconference moderator. So today, what we have on the agenda is House Bill 167, Miners in Facilities Outside of Alaska. This is the first hearing on the bill, and we intend to have a thorough hearing, and then we will set this bill aside for further consideration. And we have just been joined by Representative Mina at 3:04. So, yes, Representative Fields, if you would please introduce yourself for the record and your staff member and present the bill, and we will get going.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Zach Fields, House District 17.
For the record, Courtney Owen, staff to Representative Fields.
And I really appreciate the committee's time in considering House Bill 167, which is designed to improve care for youth with mental and behavioral health needs in our state. And the impetus for this bill was the U.S. Department of Justice report from December of last year and some follow-up discussions around that report. And I guess I'd start off by saying this is a very complicated issue with a lot of history. And I appreciate the committee taking it on. So what is the goal of this bill? I want to find what we can do as a legislature to improve in-state care and reduce reliance on for-profit, out-of-state psychiatric residential treatment facilities. There's an acronym, PRTF, for those. And these for-profit, out-of-state psychiatric residential treatment facilities are really the ones identified as being the most problematic in the U.S. Department of Justice report. And when you look at the record, unfortunately, reliance on these is expensive, results in too many cases of abuse. And when you look at the population of kids, it ends up, unfortunately, discriminating against Alaska Native children in practice. So if we can do better, if we can provide care in-state, it is both more humane and more economical. So I did circulate the Department of Justice report, but just want to summarize what it found in case members haven't had a chance to read it, because it was rather long. In Alaska, too many kids with behavioral health challenges are institutionalized out of state at high rates and for long periods. And I think it is important to note the issue is not just does someone receive treatment, but are they essentially marooned there for a long time? Is it feasible to get these kids back in state where they have community support? So the issue is not merely did they receive some kind of support out of state, but did they return? Was there a pathway to return? Many of these children, the U.S. Department of Justice found, are eligible for community-based services. And the state, according to U.S. DOJ, has not provided adequate services. And consistent with the 1115 waiver, the state must provide to must endeavor to provide community services. And again, the report really focuses on some abusive, ineffective, and expensive out-of-state care at these for-profit residential treatment centers outside of Alaska. There's been quite a bit of reporting on this, and these are just some of the headlines. And you're going to see from the dates, an article in 2019, that this goes really back a lot farther than the U.S. Department of Justice report. You know, the ADN reported 4 years ago now about how following a pretty successful campaign to, quote, bring the kids home, unfortunately, we had a little bit of backsliding. And I think it's important to contextualize the debate about what kind of care can we provide in state, what kind of care can we not provide in state, goes way back a century. So this is a debate with a lot of history. It's also important to understand the national context, and there are there's increasing private equity in involvement with some of these private residential treatment facilities. So I think when you're thinking about an out-of-state private residential treatment facility, you know, the DOJ report and also people with lived experience suggest that when a facility is out-of-state, when it's impractical for families to travel, it's hard to maintain those connections. I think it is a bit problematic to have a profit motive playing into the type of care that we provide the kids with mental and behavioral health challenges. And then when you layer on, you have private equity companies taking over these facilities, trying to extract additional profit. That makes it harder to provide the kind of care that kids need. And, you know, when you just listen to what the private equity companies themselves say, this is a quote from one of the larger ones, a for-profit company called United Health Services. Basically, this CFO is saying that they're, because there's a lack of community options, they're basically able to extract higher profit margins, again, from kids with mental health needs. And I just question if that's really appropriate. There, you know, some of these out-of-state facilities have been well documented to have cases of abuse. This is just one example. Provo Canyon School, a bunch of documented cases of abuse, including from an Alaskan named Kyra Lewis. And this was in a Salt Lake Tribune expose because Provo Canyon is down in Utah. So this little screenshot here, the troubled teen industry is how the private equity industry sees it. And they see all these programs as profit opportunities, wilderness rehabilitative programs, rehab programs, therapeutic boarding schools. So I think if the question is what could work better, we actually have some great examples from here in Alaska. There was a longstanding program called the Bring the Kids Home Initiative that was established in 2004 by the then Department of Health and Human Services and the Mental Health Trust Authority. And that program was responding to a growing number of kids being sent out of state. And I think when we look at Bring the Kids Home, by focusing on expanding in-state services, it was highly successful at expanding in-state services, providing better, cheaper care for kids with mental health issues. And what I hope this bill can be a vehicle to discuss is how do we, once again, bring the kids home, keep the kids home, get the kids back home in, for kids who have been in out-of-state for-profit facilities. How do we do that together? Because it is a complex situation where you've got now two departments, you've got the Mental Health Trust Authority, of course you have families, you have the tribal health system. So it's a complicated landscape. When you look at what the Bring the Kids Home initiative accomplished, it was very impressive in terms of reducing the number of kids out of state through expansion of services in state. And this is just a little bit of detail about that. There are opportunities right now, thanks to ongoing initiatives to provide care here in state. And this is just an image of a facility that's under construction right now, next to Bartlett Regional Hospital. And I guess I should note on this slide, if anyone reviewed the hearing in the Senate last week with the Department of Health, you know, passage of HB 172 last year provides an opportunity to improve services in state. So I think it's actually a good moment to look at what else can we do as a legislature to support those efforts. So just some additional context, you know, following that DOJ report, the Department of Health and DFCS have been working with DOJ, and those negotiations may be able to inform us of how we can support the best system in state. Workforce shortages and API being over capacity, and we kind of talked about this last week in the context of HB 80, are another area where we can look at what's the full system of care, how do we provide the best system of care in state. I think we heard that the Chilkat unit at API is consistently at or over capacity. And again, I see this bill as an opportunity to try to ask DOH, DFCS, Mental Health Trust Authority, tribal entities, and stakeholders to tell us what we can do to support the best possible system in state. And it's not my intent at all to point a finger, but to say, how can we help? So happy to take any questions. We do have an invited testimony from a couple of people with lived experience and a former director of the Mental Health Trust Authority who had direct experience with bringing the kids home, and also with Katie Baldwin Johnson, who currently works at the Trust and can talk about what our opportunities are today. And in addition to that, I appreciate legislative liaison and policy staff from both departments for being online for questions. Thank you.
Just for a time check, the presentations time estimate for those?
From the invited testifiers, I think are pretty brief.
Okay. I'm sure there will be a lot of questions.
Yeah, and I might suggest proceeding to those invited testifiers first in case their testimony answers questions.
I would go along with that. Do you want to present your specific bill before the invited testimony or proceed with the invited testimony?
Well, the sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman, is very short, so maybe we could just knock that out and then go to invite testimony.
Okay.
For the record, Courtney Owen, staff to Representative Fields. The sectional analysis is in your packet, and I'll walk the committee through it. Section 1, this section amends Alaska Statute 4714-100A to delete language that permits the department to place a child in its custody in for-profit institutions providing care outside of the state. This section adds language that clarifies that the department may place a child in its custody in a nonprofit institution providing care outside of the state. Section 2, this section amends Alaska Statute 4714-112D to require the department to report annually to the legislature on the number of children placed in nonprofit institutions providing care out of state.
That was short. Okay, do we have any questions at this point from the committee? Representative Sadler.
Very briefly, through the chair to Representative Fields. What's wrong with a for-profit institution? We provide care to people. You can provide it with Medicaid funding to for-profit hospitals and clinics and nursing homes, et cetera. I'm just not quite sure why single out profit-making institutions as undesirable or even bad or evil.
Thank you through the chair for that question. The DOJ report did identify some of those for-profit institutions as having more concerning histories of abuse. But actually, I think I might suggest going to invited testimony because some of the invited testifiers are going to address that, and they have a lot more direct experience with it than I do.
Okay. Let's see. And with that, let me see what I've got matching my piece of paper. Let me just go down the piece of paper list. We have Angela Gonzalez facing Foster Care Alaska. Angela, are you with us? We'll give that a chance to work itself out. Next, I have Eva Dennison facing Foster Care Alaska. Eva, are you with us? Not with us. Jeff Chessy, former CEO of Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Jeff, are you with us, Mr. Chessy?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Chessy. I'm currently retired. I came to Alaska in 1980 as a VISTA volunteer with disability law, was the CEO of the Mental Health Trust Authority for about 22 years, and most recently was the Dean of the College of Health at UAA for 4 years before I retired in 2021. To quote famous Yogi Berra, this is deja vu all over again. And in fact, this isn't just the second time that the state has struggled with this issue. It's actually the third time. Back in the 1980s, there was the Alaska Youth Initiative, which was designed to ameliorate the exact problem that Representative Fields and many of you are concerned about today. And a system was set up to develop individualized programs for these kids that had pretty severe needs. And if we didn't come up with community-based alternatives, not only were going to be institutionalized, but many of them were going to be sent out of state. You know, in my 40 years of experience in the mental health field, this isn't unusual. You take an issue like these kids being out of state or institutionalized, and you work on it, and you think you've got it fixed, and then you move on to your other priorities. And in the course of things, the problem starts to creep back up. And so by the time Governor Murkowski was elected and Joel Gilbertson was the commissioner, we had over not 70 kids out of state. We had well over 700 kids that were cycling into out-of-state placements every year. And so the Mental Health Trust partnered with the Department of Health and Social Services at the time, stakeholders, providers, families. The trust ended up investing over $15 million in developing the infrastructure and, if you will, the venture capital that was necessary to get people trained, provide startup funding for in-state programs, and we were able to bring the number of kids down from that well over 700 during the year to, as you've heard, we're now down to where there's about 70 kids out of state. And it really never should have been called Bring the Kids Home. It really more appropriately should have been titled Keep the Kids Home. Because once these kids get sent out of state, it's very difficult to get them back. Whether the out-of-state placement is a for-profit or a not-for-profit, once the child arrives at their facility, they're able to spend their time developing a clinical record that, not surprisingly, often concludes that being in their facility at significant cost to the state of Alaska is the best option for that particular child. So it's critical that we develop the infrastructure here in the state so that we don't get to the point where they're being sent out because it's much more difficult to get them back. And of course, there's all the trauma and disassociation that happens for these kids and their families when these kids do get sent out of state. The components for coming up with a adequate system of community placements isn't particularly complex. It's just difficult. It's a combination of making sure that your rate structure provides sufficient incentive for community providers within the state of Alaska, whether those are nonprofit providers or tribal providers or for-profit providers to be able to provide the services that the state knows that these kids need. You need to, since many of these kids are very complex and we don't necessarily have huge numbers of a particular diagnosis or combinations of diagnoses, having training available for providers so that they can have a qualified workforce to work with these kids. And of course, that's part of the workforce development effort to make sure that there are people there that are qualified that can be hired in order to serve these kids. As I said, some of them are very complicated. If you get a child who is low intellectual functioning and starts fires, that's a very challenging individual to serve in any environment. Particularly in the community. The formula that was used in the Bring the Kids Home initiative and even back when we had the Alaska Youth Initiative, again, it's not particularly complicated either. It just takes a lot of time and effort and focus. And that's to have the department working with the trust and providers and families and other stakeholders to sit down and develop a plan. And of course, the first step in the plan is to really understand who these kids are that are being sent out of state. How did they get out of state? What could or should we have done here in Alaska in order to keep them in the state? That's the beginning of developing a plan for addressing this concern over time. Now, I know all of you on this committee are on the committee because you care about these services and you care about, you know, these families and these kids. But even if that wasn't your primary motivation to look into this, the financial part of this is staggering. The amount of money that gets spent on these out-of-state placements is huge, particularly when compared with what it would cost to provide those services within the state. Now, there is a leap of faith. You know, I'm always hesitant when people tell legislators, you know, for every dollar you invest in this program, you're going to get $5 or $6 back or whatever the formula is. You know, but the fact is that investing in these community services will reduce the cost of out-of-state places. And we saw that in the Bring the Kids Home initiative. Where as we were able to invest in these community programs, we saw the number of kids placed out of state go down, and so the cost of those kids' placements out of state also went down. But you have to invest up front in order to create the community alternative so that you can keep these kids in state. But history provides a good lesson here that this is a smart to develop these services at the front end so that you can reduce your reliance on out-of-state placements and, of course, the impact on the families and children being served as close to home as possible are just incalculable. Because remember, these kids all grow up, and if they are struggling as adolescents, and we don't meet their needs at that point, then there's a good chance we're going to run into them as adults, also generally in intensive services that cost the state a lot of money. So I'm very encouraged, you know, by this getting renewed attention, you know, partly because of the Department of Justice report, but also just a growing awareness of how important providing these services are and what it can mean to the state if we're able to once again for the third time find a way to address this issue. And I'll pause for any questions.
I think we're going to go through the different testifiers first and then hold the questions for the end, if that's okay with the committee. Okay. So next on the line, I have Steve Williams, the CEO of Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Mr. Williams.
I think Katie Baldwin-Johnson may be testifying on behalf of the trust, Mr. Chairman.
I meant to say Katie Baldwin-Williams. Katie, are you with us?
Hi, good afternoon. Yes, I'm here. Thank you. For the record, I'm Katie Baldwin-Johnson, Chief Operating Officer at the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and thank you for hearing the Trust invited testimony today. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to contribute to a dialogue about how we can collectively support Alaska's youth and families. And I think to add to the topic of child mental health, it's important that to be starting this conversation, I think, with the fundamental recognition that the child exists within the family. And if we're wanting to better address child mental health, we have to also address it within the context of the family and how the two are so fundamentally interrelated and interdependent. The historical context Jeff Jesse just provided about the Bring the Kids Home initiative and how impactful that framework was for really showing quantifiable and meaningful change as the system was enhancing with progress on the recommendations that were made through that context. And I also would like to highlight, without repeating some of the comments that Mr. Jesse made, there definitely were some strategies that were initiated under that initiative that are still working today to keep kids in community. And just to highlight those briefly, one was the focus on early childhood as a bring kids home prevention strategy. And that really helped increase the attention to the age group of prenatal through age 8 and really understanding the related family services and supports that were needed, as well as paying attention to the protective factors of the family. Also, during the initiative, therapeutic foster care was identified as a prioritized alternative to inpatient care. And for those of you that are familiar with treatment foster care, it's generally out-of-home care by foster parents with specialized training in care for a wide variety of children and adolescents. So usually those that experience significant emotional or behavioral or social issues, and it's designed to provide safe care to that youth in a more structured environment than is typically provided through regular foster care. But therapeutic foster care can be a cost-effective alternative to residential treatment, as Jeff Jesse was just describing. Some of those strategies that were implemented are more cost-effective than sending youth out-of-state placement. And also just to note that that service was added to the Alaska 1115, the Medicaid waiver, in effort to enhance access to that level of support. So those are two really good strategies that were initiated back then that are worthy of further consideration and support. I would just mention that just in working with partners across Alaska on strengthening our system so that all of our beneficiaries have access to behavioral health care when they need it as close to home as possible, and of course in the least restrictive setting as possible. That's what we're all striving for here. And so what are some things that can be done? And I think I just wanted to highlight some of those, and I'm hopeful that the discussion and some of the questions that might arise from this initial conversation will lead to more conversations around this very important issue. Strengthening and growing our network of community-based services needs to be a priority. I know that it is also for the department. Finding opportunities to help organizations both plan for and access, start up, and launch operating funding is a big deal for organizations that are contemplating expansion of service or adding new services. There are capital expenses that also are included in that there often are not other resources to support that expense for organizations that are leaning into this work. We also need to Jesse mentioned the importance of looking at rates and our financing mechanisms for this. We certainly have heard from our provider, serving organizations, and advocates that we need to work on the Medicaid reimbursement structure by conducting a comprehensive review and analysis of Alaska's rates and rate-setting methodologies, which impact both behavioral health and home and community-based services in Alaska. Providers who are willing and able to provide care for people with dual diagnosis or high acuity conditions are not paid any more for the same service. And this disincentivizes the treatment of youth with complex needs and lower levels of care, which can lead to unnecessary institutionalization. So we do share this perspective on Medicaid based on our ongoing engagement with our beneficiary serving partners across the state. And again, of course, workforce, perhaps the biggest challenge in addressing many of these issues, that can be understated. And with less workforce, we have services that are closing and programs and capacity that is being lost within our state. I do hope that you'll hear from the tribal health system at some point and engage them. I want to note that the workforce challenges are exacerbated, in our rural communities, where many youth don't have access to the same care or prevention because there are limited resources such as school counselors or limited access to behavioral health providers for outpatient services. And of course, you know, we're also further challenged with working with itinerant or traveling providers. And just a few more things here before I wrap up. I do think that one of the contributing factors in access challenges for behavioral health care is the number of behavioral health providers that accept Medicaid. Aside from community health behavioral providers, independent practitioners generally do not accept Medicaid patients for a number of reasons that I'm sure others online could explain much more eloquently than I can. But we do know that that addressing that, if we had more providers that were seeing Medicaid patients, that it would expand access to care on a number of different levels, earlier intervention, outpatient care, levels of care that are opportunities to address challenges or mental health emergencies before they become more acute. We are continuing to support establishment and expansion of crisis stabilization services, working with communities across the state. I know that's a priority for the departments as well. And we certainly can't emphasize enough the importance of childhood intervention and prevention efforts. The earlier we address a child or a young person's needs, often the less acute their symptoms become. And there are many ways to do that, and I think it's part of the conversation that needs to continue to expand. Looking at expanding behavioral health resources in schools, working with different school districts across the state around those opportunities. So those are just a few things that I wanted to share, kind of piggybacking on Jeff Jesse's comments earlier. You know, certainly use of out-of-state psychiatric facilities should be the last option when all other options are exhausted. And strengthening our system of community-based services so that fewer youth will need to enter inpatient treatment has to be a collective priority and as inclusive as many of the stakeholders that Jeff Jesse mentioned earlier. And just to, you know, in closing, the trust in our role as both a grant maker and in policy and planning, we certainly are looking forward to being included in a systems approach to meeting the needs of Alaskans with state and community tribal partners to address the improvements that are needed around crisis care, around complex needs, and that focuses resources that help families and young people sooner than our current system is currently able to do so. Mm-hmm. So I will stop there. Thank you very much for your time and inviting the trust to provide comment.
Okay. And back to Angela Gonzalez. Angela?
It's Angel Gonzalez.
Angel, you're correct.
Yes.
And We're going to be running a little short of time. If we could keep the testimony a little bit shorter. And
yes.
Okay. And particularly, we're focused on the bill having to do with outside placements. Anyway, Ms. Gonzalez, if you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. My name is Angel Gonzalez. I am the president on the board for Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I was in care from the time that I was 5 in and out until I got adopted at 16. And during that time, I myself was never in any kind of treatment facility, but I have a younger brother who was, and I saw the negative effects of that treatment for him, and not just him, but many other foster siblings and foster youth that I've worked with throughout the years. And what I've witnessed is that it's more detrimental than good. I haven't really seen anyone come back from out-of-state treatment better. I've also seen, while I was working at Covenant House, the youth were worse off than when they went in. I myself was very terrified of going into treatment because of what I had seen and all the horror stories that I had heard from other foster youth and foster siblings. And I would always try my best to, like, show that I was a good child and didn't need to go into the system, or not in the system, excuse me, into treatment. There was one time where I almost did have to, purely because there was no foster placement. And right at the last minute, I was told that, like, on the way to the car, I was told that they found a placement. But I was so terrified, and I knew that I had to, I couldn't cry, I couldn't show any anger or anything like that, otherwise they would use that against me. And so I just truly believe that there needs to be something else, there needs to be more. Our foster youth and foster children need to have more supports around them and not be sent out of state. You hear these children get abused further while they're down there. They get raped. They get tranquilized pretty much, and they're like zombies. They're not themselves. The weight gain, the tics, the long-lasting effects that happen. Like, I know numerous foster youth who are now grown, who are formerly in the system, formerly in treatment, and they have long-lasting effects from all the medicines that were pumped into their system while they were in treatment. And I remember how they would tell me that they were just not themselves. And I could see it because I would know how they were before they went in. And then by the time that they came out, they were a completely different person. I've also seen, while working at Covenant House, children who were just abandoned at those out-of-state treatment centers, and then they're so institutionalized by the time that they come back, sometimes they're brought directly to the homeless shelter, and they don't know how to live. They're not reintroduced back into society, or they don't know how to engage with others, and they're picked up so quick, and their chances of getting picked up by sex traffickers, drug traffickers, or even death, getting incarcerated, like, those highly increase because those youth are targeted. The predators, they sniff them out like nothing, and it's just a detriment to our society for our youth and our children to be sent out of state, because oftentimes it does not help.
Okay, thank you. And Eva Dennison, were you able to join us? Eva. Okay, we also have Dana Brown, who is the Acting Director of Behavioral Health, Tammy Wilson, the Program Coordinator for the Department of Family and Community Services, and Christy Vogley, Special Assistant to the Department of Family and Community Services with us on Teams to answer any questions or provide information for us. So do we have questions? Do we have all of the testifiers, I think? Could you confirm that we have all of the testifiers? Okay, very good. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox, and thank you, Rep. Fields, for bringing this bill forward as a response to the DOJ report. And I am thankful for the work that the department and the administration has been done in response to the DOJ report as well, knowing that we really do need to look at a whole system approach to improving our mental health care system, especially for our youth. So I have a couple of questions related to how our system currently works with addressing this issue. My first question is, what for the department, what are the in-state resources that are considered prior to referring a youth out of state for residential treatment?
And
Mr. Chairman, I think Heather Carpenter is in the room with Farina Brown, so maybe that would be a good question for Department of Health. Thank you.
Very good. Ms. Carpenter, would you care to respond to that?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health. I will ask a clarifying question. I can certainly say that the Department of Health, you know, has our process that we go through, including exhausting any in-state placement before we consider an out-of-state placement. The departments, so both Department of Health and Department of Family and Community Services, explained in our response to the Department of Justice report, we laid out the processes we go through. It's not in our process for looking at Medicaid placements is pretty accurate, and I know we did include the OCS process as well. In terms of this bill being specific to kiddos in state custody, I will defer to Tammy Wilson to speak to the process that DFCS uses, because they are the only ones who have that placement option for those individuals in state custody.
So for the record, my name is Tammy Wilson, and I am the family coordinator for the Department of Family and Community Services. This is pretty much my full-time job on working with families and children. So just to get to the process, so when we have a child who mostly in North Star or at API in our acute facilities, then what we do is that we send out basically a packet of information to all of our in-state providers, letting them look at it, interview the child, see whether or not they will be able to meet the needs of this particular child. If they are unable to, and we get actually written denials, then and then and only then do we look out of state. And when we're looking out of state, we are looking for specialized areas. Mostly aggression, that's probably our number one issue. If a child is very aggressive toward others, those are some of our harder to place children. But what we do, we send the same packets out to all of our Medicaid facilities. We also have some non-Medicaid facilities. And what we do again, we have to get denials from all of our facilities that are Medicaid first before we look at any other facilities. But it's really about finding that specialized service for that particular child so they can get on, you know, a state of recovery from within it. We don't look whether or not they are for-profit or non-profit. It's about what services are they able to get. And then it's based on also the discharge plan from those medical providers on what they need and what type of facility we're supposed to look at. We don't choose that. That's chosen by the discharge plan.
Thank you. Follow-up? For the wait times of a child that is waiting to be referred to an out-of-state facility, is there a difference in wait times between nonprofits and for-profits?
Not that I have found. Where the wait list is after COVID, a lot of our facilities did not open up to the same number of beds that they had before COVID. And so some of our more specialized ones are the ones with the wait list because there's just so few of them and so few beds that they fill up quicker.
Follow-up? Through the chair, what is the wait time or duration on average?
So it's really hard to say, but I would say many of those that we're looking at, we need a placement now. So if we have a wait list, we usually go beyond that place and try to find one without a wait list. Lately, we've found a few more wait lists, and we've got a couple of them that are about a week to 2 weeks. And with that, normally they can't stay at an acute hospital, so we have to find a placement in between while they're waiting for that placement to open up.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair. When a child is waiting, what does that look like? Where are they? Are they receiving any other types of services simultaneously? And who's with them?
So most of the time when we have a child that's waiting, especially if they are at North Star API, a lot of times if we have a bed and we're literally just waiting for that bed to open up, they will keep them there and wait for that opening to happen. However, we have had issues where we've had a child maybe in therapeutic homes or in a foster home, and they had a severe blow up, but they're not enough to where they go to an acute hospital, but they need a higher need. And we have had to use what we call security when they stay within a hotel room for those openings to happen. Normally that's still only for a few days because there's a process we have to go through to be able to get those children to that appropriate place. But again, that's only if we can't find an in-state provider first.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I'm not certain who the question would be directed to, but from my recollection of some of the concerns around this issue was the amount of money that Medicaid pays for residential services by comparison state to state. So some states will essentially, lobby for other states' Medicaid rates. So I guess my question is, what is the rate that our state Medicaid pays for residential treatment? And is there a different cost for inpatient in-state and inpatient out-of-state?
We have a
volunteer. For the record, this is Heather Carpenter with the Department of Health, and I have Deputy Director Karina Brown here with me. So rates are individualized for each provider, and we have a process we go through where providers enroll, and they do accept our Alaska rates. I will defer to Director Brown to fill in more details.
For the record, Karina Brown, Acting Director, Division of Behavioral Health. Through the chair, each state we'll go through a rate setting process that is in collaboration with the Division of Behavioral Health and the Office of Rate Review. And we review the information that specifically identifies what are the specialty areas that that particular facility offers. And then we will set a rate. That rate can at times be their in-state Medicaid rate, or it could be higher. We have a set Medicaid rate for Alaska, and at present, we have a higher rate that we pay in-state for in-state psychiatric residential treatment facilities than we pay for out-of-state. An out-of-state PRTF facility would not automatically receive the in-state Alaska rate. Again, it goes through a very strict rate setting review process between the Office of Rate Review and the Division of Behavioral Health, where a rate will be established. The rate can at times increase based on the specialty services that they offer. But again, that's a strict review of the professionals that are staffed at that facility. And then what is the exact criteria? For example, there is one facility in the United States that operates as a psychiatric residential treatment facility that serves the hard of hearing and deaf. So they have an extremely high rate because of the specialty that they offer.
Just to follow up, if I may. Thank you, through the chair, and thank you for that answer. That was very, very detailed and had a lot of information in there. So I guess based off of that answer, is it a regulation or I assume it's probably not legislative policy that would essentially say the state of Alaska Medicaid program is never going to pay or should never pay above what the, in-state residential treatment would be for another state. Is that a policy that would be set internally? Is that something that the legislature could give guidance on? I don't want other states competing essentially to say, well, Alaska pays high, and so we'll lobby for Alaska kits.
For the record, this is Heather Carpenter, again, healthcare policy advisor with the Department of Health. I think that's a really good question and concept. And, you know, we have to be really careful when we're thinking about rates and how we set rates. We have to work with CMS and follow. It's very much a rules-based system, so we can't just be arbitrary and capricious in how we set our rates. We also, when we're thinking about the facilities that Farina shared and those specialties, we are trying to make sure we have access for our kiddos who might need highly specialized care. Our goal, and because, you know, we are highlighting the Department of Justice report, is to have as many services in state to keep kiddos in state in their home region at that lower level of care and only escalate up if necessary. So when we are thinking about rates, we want to make sure we're incentivizing in-state providers to provide this care, which highlights the work that Katie Baldwin-Johnson with the Trust said about us looking kind of comprehensively at our rates. So Representative Ruffridge, when we are thinking about this, I don't want to give you a, you know, could you set that or not? I will go back and do some homework. CMS has told us other things we have to follow, which I've shared with Representative Fields, is there is guidance material that has come out that we have to allow any willing provider to enroll in Medicaid. And what that means is we can't actually stop them from enrolling on the basis of for-profit or nonprofit. So we can certainly, and we do, ensure that people are following Medicaid rules and there are safety, you know, procedures in place. And we take it very seriously when a kiddo or, you know, an adult that's getting care in any facility, whether it's in-state or out-of-state, has a situation where they are not safe. We took the situations at North Star very seriously and followed up to ensure those kids were safe, and we do the same thing out of state. We don't send a kid out of state lightly, and when we do, so they can get that care, we need to ensure that safety is there. And just for the committee's education, because this is a heavy and meaty topic, when we are thinking about placement of kids out of state, I do just want to emphasize that the Department of Health cannot make any final placement decisions. We work with the kiddo's parent or guardian, or if in the case of a kiddo who's in state custody, we work with the Office of Children's Services or the Department, the Division of Juvenile Justice. So we just help ensure there are facilities enrolled to provide this care, but we're not making that final placement decision alone.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
Representative Ruffridge may already have this story, but the Kaiser Family Foundation published an article entitled Profit Strategy, Psychiatric Facilities Prioritize Out-of-State Kids from April of 2022, and we can circulate that to the committee that does provide some additional context on his question.
I guess just to clarify that question, if I understood Ms. Carpenter, I think, correctly, the rates are fairly controlled, and as far as Alaska is concerned, you're looking for the provider that can provide the service is what drives it, whether starting in state and then going out of state. So the question of providers competing on price or looking for a higher price service, can that come into play?
Again, for the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health. Chair Prax, you know, you are correct. I mean, bottom line, we're looking for providers to enroll, and we cannot pay Medicaid rates, Medicaid at all, until a provider enrolls in Alaska Medicaid, and then we start that process of what that rate is going to be. And when we're looking at, you know, a facility-based rate, there is a whole process to set that rate and how we have to go about that. For comparison, when we're setting Medicaid rates for our hospitals in Alaska, for instance, they are all individual, and those are cost-based rates. And like I said, rate setting is definitely nuanced, and we'd be happy to provide a little additional follow-up to the committee on how those Medicaid rates are set for these facilities that are both in-state and out-of-state.
And Mr. Chairman, this is Tammy Wilson, family coordinator. I just want to clarify, too, these facilities are not soliciting us. We have children with very high needs. We are soliciting them. So, you know, when we're talking about the difference between out-of-state and in-state, we're looking for a much higher level of placement than what we currently offer. So although any one of us would rather keep our children in-state all the time, at the same time, some of these are so specialized, you know, we don't have enough with these type of issues that we can have an in-state placement option. So it is going out and soliciting the best place for that child, no matter who that child is, in state custody, to be able to get the care they need. And then the other part of my job is, now that they're placed in that placement where they're going to get the care that they need, is from day one, is what that discharge is going to look like, right? When they come back to Alaska, it's not just about finding that next family for them to stay until they can be reunified, but it's making sure that they have all the coordination that they need, that the counselor is set up, that they need medication, that everything is ready for them to be successful at that out-of-state placement, come back, continue down the line to be successful, to be reunited with their family. So I just wanted to make sure that we clarify that we're not having people knocking our door saying, you know, take our kids there, because one, we wouldn't answer the door, because it's about us finding the right placement for our kids, because that's what this is all about, right? Where do we want them to get the right kind of help to break the cycle so that they can move forward in their life and become, you know, that teenager that, you know, we want them to be to the adulthood and not living in an institution for the rest of their lives.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sadler, and then Representative Sumner also asked some questions.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Prox. Former Representative Wilson, good to see your face there. Good to hear your voice. A question to whomever there who can answer it. This is a big, meaty topic, and there's many, many questions I'd like to ask, but where is the shortage coming? If the Bring the Children Home, Bring the Kids Home initiative relied on home and community-based services, and we did have the staffing at one point, where is the shortage right now? Is it in any particular area of skill, or just an overall people that are not willing to work for what Medicaid reimburses? But what's the genesis of the shortage that prevents us from providing services to these children in Alaska?
Now, this is Tammy Wilson, family coordinator. If I had that answer, you know, I'd be making a lot more money. So that is the question of the day. I mean, Representative Sadler, it really is that, you know, where are the gaps at? And we started the complex care unit so that we can take that time and really dig deep and say, you know, why are we having to send our children out? You know, if we had gotten different kind of care at the beginning, would we still be there? And so, you know, part of it is that it's not just about children, right? We have, you know, youth, and we have adults. We have a lot of people in the system that need behavioral health assistance. And so figuring out how much you need for each region has been an issue. But right now, it really is workforce. I don't know where everybody went, but it seems like, you know, we were already on the edge, and then they disappeared, right? They couldn't stay in business or whatever it was. So we kind of are having to start in square one on some of those. But a lot of it is therapy. I would say would be the number one portion of it, the right kind of counseling for the right type of thing. And then I think substance abuse, not just for adults, but we have a lot of youth that need it as well, is a pretty big gap that it has come to the forefront. And then last, but it's specialized foster care. We need more foster care that have had exceptional training, because a lot of these children that we are seeing are a lot more complex than we've seen in the past. And we want to make sure that when a child is placed, they're placed in a trained family and one where they could be successful to keep everybody safe in that home and make it so that that child doesn't continuously have to be moved.
If you could indulge me, this is not really a follow-up. It's kind of a different topic, but it's the same question I asked of the sponsor earlier. To the chair, to whomever out there in Teams world can answer, is there anything intrinsically improper about for-profit facilities, institutions outside? I know it's not a preferred placement, and I share the reticence personally, believe me. But is there anything that the for-profit nature of an institution, anything about them that make them just intrinsically improper placements?
Okay, this is Tammy Wilson, family coordinator. I work with both types of facilities, and honestly, until this bill got put up and I had to go look them up, I couldn't have told you which ones were nonprofits and which ones were for-profit, because we require the same out of all of them. You know, we have to, you know, when they are placed there, They immediately work on a discharge plan. There are weekly treatment meetings. Everybody is working together on, you know, how that child's doing, what extra needs they need, do we need medication, making sure they have approval of those, and literally being successful. But like I said, until this came up, I couldn't have told you which ones, you know, are for profit or not profit, because the ones that we pick, our Department of Health is very picky based on what they have to do to make sure that these are excellent facilities. And it really is about their specialty and how they handle the children, not what their status is.
Okay. Representative Sumner.
Yeah, through the chair to the sponsor, I was going to see if you would like to address the fiscal note. I'm reading the analysis here, and it's probably one of the more aggressively oppositional pieces that I've seen. On one part, it discusses that they'll have to remodel all the OCS offices for overnight stays, and then it says the department's initial estimates of fiscal impact of HB 167 pale in comparison to overwhelming negative impact vulnerable and medically fragile children will experience as they're made to wait an indeterminate amount of time to receive medically necessary prescribed therapeutic care.
Yeah. So happy to, through the chair. Thanks, Representative Sumner. So this is one of those bills, like Representative Sadler and others mentioned, the underlying topic is complex enough. I didn't think I could, frankly, get it all right without going through the hearing process and hearing from stakeholders in this committee and getting input from all the members of the committee. So I very consciously put out a bill that identified one problem identified by DOJ without thinking that the bill as written should pass. I hope that the bill prompts discussion and ideas. I do think there's a lot of documentation, including from people in Alaska with lived experience, about the problems with for-profit out-of-state placements. I do think we should think about the best way to make sure that they are never used except as a last resort. But really, the bill needs to be fleshed out with strengthening in-state care. And I think it's actually a perfect time to contemplate that with the Department of Health standing up this working group this month that'll be working over the summer. They're looking at rates. So my hope is between now and January of next year, we all have a chance to think about what we think should be in the bill, make it line up with the work that the department and stakeholders are doing over the summer, listen to more people who have experience in this field. I don't have direct experience. And then by the time we come back with a CS or an amended bill, it is more comprehensive. I guess I was a little surprised that no one else had introduced a bill in response to the DOJ report, because the report in the, that report is one of the more troubling things I've read in the time I've been in the legislature.
I will, if I may.
Yeah, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if Mr. Williams or Mr. Jesse are still available to us for questions.
Mr. Jesse?
Yes, this is Mr. Jesse. I'm here.
Thank you. Through the chair, Jeff, Mr. Jesse, Dan Sadler here. Just curious, kind of going upstream, I understand that we have some big challenges in Alaska. They seem to be kind of fundamental to our stature as a remote state with a lot of rural areas. But moving farther up the causation chain, does Alaska have more or less children in need of foster care, children in need of therapeutic foster care? Or is this, are we the same as any other state? And I guess I'd just ask your thoughts on how we can try and reduce the number of people coming in the pipeline at the early end. Your general thoughts, please.
Yeah, Representative Sadler through the chair. You know, I've never really done a comparison of how our incidence compares to other states, but every state struggles with this. And, you know, I appreciate the perspective of looking upstream. I'm sure that all the members of this committee are familiar with the adverse childhood experience data and research that has been done. And we know that these kids that end up in these institutions or in need of intensive community services have often a very high incidence of childhood trauma. And so anything that we can do to support them and their families early on and minimize the amount of that trauma is going to reduce the need for these intensive services later on. So Again, working closely, I think Katie Baldwin mentioned this, working closely with the school. You know, that's a great place to identify these kids early on. As you can imagine, most elementary school teachers, they can pick them out in a hurry because they've seen a lot of kids and they see what the early signs and warning signs are. And I think more collaboration with our educational system would really help us identify these kids earlier, reduce their burden of trauma, and then I'm certain that that will then reduce the need for this level of service.
Thank you.
I'll ask another philosophical kind of question. I often hear through the chair to probably Jeff, Jesse, if you're willing to take it. I hear that there is an inadequate supply of community-based services in rural Alaska. I know that there's Alaska has a lot of challenges with its population, and that we don't really reach a critical mass of service providers to service requirers until you get to the larger cities. Is it realistic to expect to provide the range of community-based services throughout rural Alaska that might be needed?
Well, Representative Sadler, through the chair, certainly in a small village, you can't have the entire continuum of care all the way up to what you would get in a residential psychiatric treatment center. But the tribal health system has developed a number of resources. For example, we now have behavioral health aides in many of our villages. And again, referencing your earlier question, you know, that's a great opportunity to bring those resources to bear on these families and their children early so that we may not need to get them out of the village or certainly not past a regional hub. If we're able to wrap around services early in the process. So the tribal health system is very robust, and they do have, as I said, community health aides, behavioral health aides. So we do have the raw materials in a lot of our smaller communities that could be a tremendous help in working on this problem. And I think that's, again, why Katie Baldwin-Johnson mentioned working with the tribal organizations, because as you said, in rural Alaska, that's where you have to go, to the schools and to the health corporations, and they have to be partnering with the state on addressing this issue.
Thank you.
First, any other questions from other committee members? There was the history, I think, was mentioned at some point. We were up to 700 children placed in care facilities out of state. That was worked down towards 70. Do we have an idea of the scope of the problem today?
Mr. Chairman, I think it is about 70 today, and I believe the number of those who are in DFCS or state custody are in the 20s, but would defer the department on additional details.
Do we have anyone from the department that could provide an estimate?
This is Heather Carpenter, for the record, with the Department of Health. I can speak to the Medicaid numbers. And just for historical context, what we testified to last year in the other body is at the height of when we were starting Bring the Kids Home, there were actually 965 children in out-of-state placement in 2004. And remember, that's all children either covered by Medicaid or in state custody. As of yesterday, those children that we are paying Medicaid dollars for, that is reduced to 70 children out-of-state. And just for the committee's awareness as well, since the Department of Justice started this investigation in 2020, we have actually further reduced our out-of-state placements by 25%. And I'll defer to my colleagues at the Department of Family and Community Services to discuss the number of those kiddos out-of-state who are in state custody.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chrissy Vogeli. I'm Special Assistant for the Department of Family and Community Services.
In terms of the number of kids in custody who are in out-of-state facilities, as of yesterday, the number is 25. And based on historical records that I have going back to 2008 at any given time, there's been about 30 children in state custody who have been in out-of-state placements.
And I'd just like to add, Mr. Chairman, this is Tammy Wilson with Family Coordinator. I just want to remind the committee, too, that before any child can go out into an out-of-state placement, you know, it does have to go through the court system. We have what's called an 087 hearing, and it has to be presented to the courts to a judge on why they need to go out of state, why we cannot take care of those needs here. And then that is also reviewed every 6 months to make sure that those things, you know, that out-of-state placement is still necessary. So although we may be the ones looking for the placement to find it, we can't do it without a judge signing off on it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Heather. I do apologize. I'm hearing the number 70, then I heard the number 25 children in custody. Could someone differentiate, please, what the distinction between those two numbers is, and slowly for me? Because you used some pretty precise modifiers. I want to make sure I don't make any assumptions I should not make about these children.
For the record, this is Heather Carpenter with the Department of Health. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the number I used was 70, so that means that children who Medicaid is their payment source to these facilities. The difference when we think about this and why we're tracking two different numbers is because Medicaid is a payment source. And as I mentioned, we don't make that final placement decision. That is the parent or the guardian when we're looking at appropriate placement for a child. What you heard Chrissy Vogley testify to, that 25 number, those are children in state custody. So that means a child that might be in the Office of Children's Services custody or the Division of Juvenile Justice. And how the statutes are written, it's that you are in the custody of the department. So that's why we try to look at it, you know, broadly, so we're encompassing all kids who might be in the custody of the Department of Family and Community Services.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And Heather, Ms. Carpenter, to follow up. So is it fair to assume that those 25 children in state custody are also are a subset of those 70 children who are on Medicaid payment for the services?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, by and large, yes. However, sometimes when we're looking at a very specialized need that a youth might have, and I know Tammy can speak to some of the work she's done over the last year, we have to look for a provider who can meet that need. And sometimes that might mean a provider who's not currently enrolled in the Alaska Medicaid program. I really thank Tammy because she has worked to actually get new providers enrolled in the Medicaid program to meet specialized needs. So by and large, yes, that usually encompasses it all, but there's always this very small, less than, you know, what you can count on one hand, number that you might have a different scenario.
Thank you.
So this is Tammy Wilson with DCFS. So we currently have 5 children who are in what we call private pay agreements. And when we do a private pay agreement with a facility, it's because they are not enrolled in Medicaid. But one of the requirements is when we have that child placed there is that they work toward being enrolled in Medicaid because we, you know, it gives us more options for these specialty portions of it. So, you know, it's not one of those things where we keep going with a private pay agreement. It's to give that bridge between getting the necessary care for that child, but at the same time, making sure that they enroll in Medicaid with the rest of our facilities.
Representative Sadler.
On the theory that the state has an obligation, but the state obtains the most bang for a buck through federal match if we can actually get them enrolled in Medicaid, I presume is the dynamic. Yeah, I got to say that it's a very complicated system you all work in, and there's many facets, and I don't want to, you know, grab one leg of the elephant and make sure and assume that I know all about the whole system and what it needs.
Mr. Sadler, this is Tammy Wilson from DCFS. You're absolutely correct. I mean, you know, if it goes through the Medicaid process, then most of the time it's 50-50 versus if we have to go to a private pay agreement, it is 100% general funds. However, we do have a few that where we may only have one child that may ever use that facility, and they have to make that determination whether or not it's also beneficial for them. But Most of the ones that we've been using currently are somewhere, and I don't know enough about Medicaid, but to be dangerous, are in the process, you know, being authorized within that program.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, I have a question for the bill sponsor. Is there any other state that has legislation to prohibit out-of-state for-profit or PTC referrals for kids?
Through the chair, I don't know.
Thanks.
And that segues into another question. I believe that there were some questions about some legal challenges to trying to enforce specific organizations, be it profit or nonprofit. And I believe Meg Burgard is on the line from Ledge Legal. Do we have Ledge Legal on the line? Margaret, I'm sorry. She was, not now. That one is left to another time.
Mr. Chairman, I can't say I didn't. That was not a concern that was flagged by Ledge Legal. But again, this bill was designed to get input from a broad range of stakeholders. And I think the question in my mind is, how do we, hearing from both people with lived experience who I think we have to take what they say seriously,
sure.
But also understanding the practicalities that there are specialized cases. I think the question in my mind, which I would want input from the department on, is how do we best prioritize care in the language of this bill or otherwise in a way that's both legal but supports the best care? Mm-hmm. Because there's a little bit of a discrepancy between, I think, good faith efforts in the department, but what also what we hear from people with lived experience.
Sure. And then that brings up another question. Of the population of children or people needing the service, we're talking about needing the most. Is it the most intense or the most complicated needs? From, I don't know, is that a Tammy question?
This is Tammy Wilson with DCFS. It's both. I mean, they are very complex and intensive. I mean, these are, you know, unfortunately, children who, you know, are so aggressive that they attack others, including staff. And most of those, you know, if they get to where we're looking at out of state, it's because they've been into the acute hospital and they've had those same aggressions going out there. So, and I just want to address the whole, you know, what Representative Fields said is that it is our responsibility at DCFS when we place a child in a facility to make sure that we are following that child along the way and we're getting all the notes. And we're lucky because our partners at DOH through the Medicaid process also follow the child because they're the payment source, although we have the child. So I'm not going to say that things haven't happened in the past, but I think what's set up now is much more intensive. And I think now adding the complex care unit, in which that is our full-time job, is to make sure not that we find the appropriate placement and that if out of state is that, and that's what the judge has agreed to, then our next part is making sure that we get them back here in Alaska to continue being able to be successful. And that really has been where the hole has been, and it's gotten more services have helped that to where we did have children in the past that stayed way longer than any of us would have liked to see in an out-of-state placement because we had nothing to bring them back to. But as Bring the Kids Home and other initiatives have come, our services have grown. It's just also as they've grown, some of our kids have become even more complex, kind of keeping us moving that needle, trying to make sure we have the most appropriate placements for them because really it's about their success within our system.
And well, I'm supposed to let the committee quote first, so I will do that. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair and respectful of this, thank you. I'm going to ask anybody with DOH or FCS to give us some encouragement or some hope here. I know this. We are discussing some very practical, very difficult challenges. Please give me hope that the services we provide to these troubled children and youth, that there are success cases, there are victories, and that it's important that we do work for them and expand those victories. How successful is our treatment, our system of treatment programs and therapies?
This is Tammy Wilson from DCFS. We've come a long way. I mean, think about the numbers, 900 and some kids out of state. Now we're under 25. I just had a young man who had been in a treatment center, not under even state custody, that needed assistance just finding what that next step is. He's in a family-like setting now. The family is able to come visit him every weekend where he used to, that didn't happen. He's doing really, really well where he's at. I would say there's more successes than not. It's just those that we struggle with, we remember and lose sleep over because we want to find that right placement for them. So I think in any state, you're always going to struggle with trying to figure out where that balance is on what type of services that you need. But just the number alone of how many children, you know, are not out of state anymore and how much more successful we're being about getting them discharged quicker and into the appropriate type of level of care says a lot for everybody who came before us, because I guarantee you we're not the first ones who struggle over this 24 hours a day trying to make sure that we do the right thing.
And for the record, this is Heather Carpenter with the Department of Health. I'd just like to add on from our perspective, and through the chair, Representative Sadler, I actually have a direct family member who received care in one of these out-of-state PRTFs and was unable to receive the care in-state. You know, North Star wasn't high enough, went out-of-state, stabilized, came back home, and is doing really well, is hooked back up into community services. We have a lot of those stories. And I want to echo what Tammy said, that we've all experienced, these are all individuals with stories and lives, and it's really important to us. We work these individual cases and try to find the best placement. Another story of hope, and that what the legislature has done and the department has done to set the groundwork to change this tide, is the 1115 waiver. And of course, Representative Sadler, you remember fondly, I'm sure, that this was part of Senate Bill 74 in 2016. And it's taken us, you know, a long time to get that off the ground. But that was really to build up and to build on, bring the kids home, to have those community level services. So we're getting kids and adults care at the lower level before they escalate and need that higher level of care. And that is still our goal, is to have these kind of services in every region of the state so we can keep kids home, closer to culture, closer to their family. And the Department of Justice pointed out in their report that the 1115 really is the underpinning of how we solve this on the behavioral health side. So we're excited. And one thing that is in the waiver, and of course we're going through the waiver renewal, is that we actually expanded these Medicaid-covered services to individuals who are at risk of developing a mental health or a substance use disorder. And this was a pretty profound change, an important policy call, because prior to that, somebody already had to be in that. So if you're an adult, you had to meet that definition, which means a clinician diagnosed you as having a serious mental illness or a severe emotional disturbance for children. And at-risk is not allowable criteria outside of the waiver. And we did this to think about how do we get services to kids sooner so they don't escalate out. And we know looking and partnering with our schools more is a big solution. But another thing that we all have to think about collectively that's, you know, one bubble outside of the Medicaid program is how do we get more providers in state? How do we ensure we have providers to do these youth services? And when these kiddos age out, how do we ensure we have enough home and community-based service providers for our adult system? When you're thinking about when an individual qualifies for those 1915C waivers that you hear the KEY campaign come and, you know, discuss about making sure there's enough of those available and no wait list. So all of that goes together, because when we're thinking about these services, we know we have to serve these kids now, but we have to make sure those services exist for when they do become adults. And it's really important to the department that we have a full continuum of care across the board.
Okay, thank you. And apparently we are reducing the number of, well, I guess children, but patients, we'll call it, children or adults, patients in out-of-state care. And of course, that's only one part of this, but can you identify things that have happened that the department has done to bring that number down? Is it just that the, to put it coldly, has the market shifted, or have what specific things should we focus on or have we focused on that seem to have brought the number down? And should we continue to focus on going forward?
Again, this is Heather Carpenter, and I can speak a little bit broadly. We've done a lot. I mean, that number alone, it's hard to pinpoint one thing we've done because it's a collection of things, you know, over the last 20 years that have all played together to reduce that number. It's continued technical assistance that we've offered providers to help them stand up and provide this care in home or in state. And it's efforts like the Complex Behavioral Collaborative that we come in and offer that technical assistance to providers when they might be serving a complex youth or adult with unique behaviors and how they can tailor that work for better outcomes. And that was, you know, a really important step we've done. We offer, you know, one-on-one services with providers to ensure they can do that and that we have family members who have access to care. We've continued, the big game changer structurally is the 1115 and making sure we brought on new service lines that could be reimbursed. So we were reducing the reliance on just grant based efforts. And again, we've collectively looked at the rates and how we can, you know, slowly rebase or provide an uptick. The department just this spring finalized a 4.5% increase to our 1115 rates. But by no means is that, you know, the end all be all. We know we need to do further work on that. So I think it's hard for me to just say we've done one thing. And I will say the department in our response, and I will make sure, Mr. Chairman, that you have it. In our response to the Department of Justice report, we highlighted a lot of the efforts that both departments collectively have taken to address this.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Is there any questions we forgot to ask? Anything else that somebody would like to add to help contribute to this discussion? Because it's a difficult topic. There's always room for improvement, and that's, I'm sure, what everybody is here to try to do. So have we forgotten anything that should be mentioned?
So this is Tammy Wilson from DCFS. I just wanted to just really brief on the fiscal note, why, because it made it sound like it was done on purpose. If we end up taking half of our private, you know, for-profit RTCs to where we cannot utilize them, that means over half of the children we currently have in care would have no place to go. And that's really what we based it upon, you know, and I think our check and balance again is, you know, when we find a facility that's right for that child and if it happens to be out of state, you know, again, it's not just a choice that we just made out of the air. Is we've got a strict process that we have to go through, make sure there's no other alternative, make sure that the judge understands what we're trying to do and he agrees with that. And then again, every month we're having meetings, treatment meetings, discharge plans, and then figuring out how we use those services here. And one last thing is that even the Office of Children's Services have increased their rates as well. So we have some what we call augmented rates, higher pay for those children that are a little bit harder, take more time, more appointments to go to. So we're hoping, because it just happened just about a month ago, that we'll have more families willing to do the extra training and take some of these children who are kind of borderline right now who might still be able to stay in the state. So, you know, we're taking all the right positive steps. It just everything takes a little time to make sure that we're doing it right, because you're talking about the lives of these children, their safety, not just of them, but their family and the providers that they'll be living with until we can finally get them back home.
And Mr. Chairman, this is Heather Carpenter again with the Department of Health. In the spirit of, you know, any other information the department should have, we also point out in our response to the Department of Justice, we're going to be bringing together a steering committee this month and starting a process of hearing from individuals who are really on the front lines and our providers. And then the department's plan to undertake, you know, regional work groups and listening sessions. We really appreciate the attention that legislators are giving this topic. And I thank Representative Fields for that. And we know we're going to need to come back with you probably next session with, here are some things that the regions have told us we need to do to help get more services in each region. That's where we're going to be relying on our tribal health partners and those individuals with lived experience. And it's just going to take all of us to solve this. So I'm, you know, kind of put that on notice that I'm sure you're going to want to hear from us again, and we're going to be providing you updates. And I'm looking forward to hearing what each region says they need to do to get more services in region as well.
Mr. Chairman, can I jump in on that?
Representative Fields.
Thanks. I'm glad that Ms. Carpenter brought that up, because I think it's not as simple an issue of in-state, out-of-state, you know, to the extent that we're taking a kid outside their home region and bringing them to Anchorage, for example. You know, that's not ideal. We should be providing those services in region. and those regional work groups are very important. Thank you.
And you mentioned a steering committee. I might have heard the word task force earlier this afternoon. Is that the same thing?
Chair Prax, again, this is Heather Carpenter. We're using the term steering committee, but I guess in this you could probably use them interchangeably, but we're going to move as quickly as we can, especially if there needs to be something we need to come back next legislative session for action.
Okay. Will you be reporting to the legislature, I guess, before the next session?
Mr. Chairman, we don't per se have plans to necessarily report out. However, I think the nature of we have very interested legislative committees, and this will be a public process. So I think we will ensure our stakeholders and our policymakers are well informed of the efforts we are doing, especially if we're going out to somebody's region. I don't think a legislator would appreciate us showing up without giving them a heads up that we're going to be coming and talking to providers in their communities.
Okay. Anything else from the committee or whatever? All right. Well, thank you, Representative Fields. You have definitely started a worthwhile conversation, and this is something that I'm sure the committee is working or is interested in working on, and I would be interested in getting together perhaps a couple of times in the interim so that we are prepared and can do what's necessary without getting in the way.
Thank you.
And with that, I thank everyone that has joined us today. This was a very informative and valuable discussion, and I'm sure we will have more. So with that, we will we will adjourn the Health and Social Services Committee at 4:34. Thank you.